Blog Talk Radio. question, but I don't think it had any impact on. In any single day in Afghanistan in the last decade. So we've been there, so that's a serious loss of life.
The bottom line is this should not be a call for the U.S. to pull out. The only time the U.S. should think about leaving Afghanistan is once they have effectively trained the Afghan military and the police to be able to deal with the constant threat of insurgents that are being supported by Iran.
I don't think
because we've been there 10 years and we're still having the same conversation about what we're trying to do. We went in for the first couple of years and cleaned out the original Al-Qaeda nest that was in there, although we didn't catch Osama until later. And then we kind of neglected them and went to Iraq, and then we went back there, and now we're still trying to fit it. It doesn't seem to me like we're making any progress. Well, I respectfully have a different point of view, only respectfully. And I just think that, you know, we're not going to accomplish whatever it is that we say we're going to accomplish, and we should just leave.
Well,
just leave.
The problem is we are doing effective things on the ground. It's the Iranians that are helping the insurgents, and that's where everything becomes problematic.
Well, both these guys bring up an interesting point, and that is that because there's this difference of opinion. Are we making progress? Are we not? Is it clear what our objective is, or is it not? We've been there 10 years. This is where presidents have a huge duty and opportunity to make it clear what exactly the objectives are and how we're doing. We know a lot about what the time frame is for leaving. We know less about the benchmarks for leaving successfully.
Bob, you had a comment.
Well, you know, one of the things we have to keep in mind, and I'm not suggesting it's good, bad, or indifferent why we're in there or not, but we as a country, I mean, we know how to fight wars with tanks and airplanes, and there's the army over there, and that's the battlefield. There's no battlefield in this country, just as there was no battlefield in Iraq. And when you're fighting against indigenous populations, part of the population of the country, which has a disagreement with the government, and they're trying to upset the government, and we're trying to protect the government, and at the same time teach the government how to protect itself and root out its own bad problems, it's awfully hard for us to do that. And we don't do it very well, and there's no reason why we should be able to do it very well. It's hard to do things like that when you can't tell a good guy from a bad guy walking down the street. And it's a problem that is just so difficult, it really makes you feel, once you get into something like this, you have to understand how bad it's going to be, and you really have to decide it's really, really important for us. And once Obama got away the first time, maybe we should
have...
What did I say?
Once Osama got away,
and we didn't get him at Tora Bora, the fact of the matter was, it might have made sense for us at that point just to stay away.
Well, John, you had a
comment. Yeah, exactly. Bob's right. But the other thing, we didn't go there to try to prop up the indigenous government, the existing government. It wasn't there. We went there to clean out Al-Qaeda, and I don't know that it's more important to be Afghanistan or to be in, God forbid that we should go there, Yemen or Somalia, where we tried to go, and that was the last time you had a tragedy of this proportion. I'm not talking about the numbers, but I'm talking about the impact of Black Hawk Down. And it's just kind of hard to distinguish, you know, where should we be doing this? And I don't think we should be doing it anywhere over there.
I want to jump in on you bring up Black Hawk Down. I had the opportunity while I was in Florida to get to know Colonel Denny McKnight, who, for those who saw the movie Black Hawk Down, Colonel McKnight was portrayed by Tom Sizemore. He was Tom Sizemore's character. When you hear him talk about what happened in Somalia, which largely was a humanitarian mission versus a combat mission against armed combatants, it strikes me, I think we're comparing apples to oranges when we compare what happened in Somalia and the events there versus what's happening currently in Afghanistan. I don't think we necessarily went into, at least in my opinion, what I've gathered, that Somalia, because Somalia is back on the radar screen. They're talking about another humanitarian mission, not unlike what happened in the 90s, that ended up becoming Black Hawk Down, back into the Horn of Africa, into Mogadishu. I think it's apples and oranges, because there's a need for us in both spots, in my opinion. I think that if we allow Afghanistan to continue to run in what has amounted to total anarchy since the original Soviet invasion, we can't allow that. It definitely puts America in a clear and present danger. Bob?
Well, you say it puts us in a situation of clear and present danger. I'm not so sure that's accurate anymore. I think the Taliban has been fundamentally damaged. An awful lot of their leadership has been killed. Most of it happens to be in Pakistan. And we have killed an awful lot of those guys who were set on getting us. Now we basically have a struggle for who's running Afghanistan. And quite frankly, I don't care who's running Afghanistan. If they're going to fuss among themselves, that's up to them. Remind yourself, Afghanistan has never been a united, free country with a single, independent central government in its history.
Well,
the last time it was organized by one person, it was Alexander the Great. Right.
And I agree with that assessment, but you need a strong and stable government in Afghanistan to prevent the Iranians from coming in and exerting their own influence and creating another Islamic state.
Well, but I would go even further. You know, one of my favorite movies of all time is Charlie Wilson's War. I adore Charlie Wilson when he was alive. God bless him. Charlie Wilson's War, I think, was an accurate depiction.
I love this.
But Charlie Wilson was right. What we did in Afghanistan during Charlie Wilson's War was spot on. We helped Afghanistan thwart off the Soviet invasion. What we didn't do, and Charlie Wilson is quoted by saying, and the quote shows up at the end of the movie, we went in and did everything right, and we effed up the end game.
We walked away.
By pulling out directly, even now, we cannot just walk away. Now, are there other mechanisms? We should involve USAID. We should involve TDA. We should involve the State Department. We've got to at least, if we walk away again, we stand the chance, we stand the risk of having another Osama bin Laden being created in some of these madrasas that are run by the Taliban.
Oh, yeah, but we're always fighting the last war. You know, we created the space for the Taliban is what we did by walking away. We created the vacuum.
Absolutely we did.
And the vacuum was filled.
Alan,
and the vacuum's got to be filled. Somebody
Alan,
else.
I'm not sure.
A vacuum was created. I'm not defending what we did before, but I'm not sure that we had a lot of great options when we did pull out. What I was just thinking as we were talking about it is, We had all of these guys. We gave them armaments. We taught them how to use them. They filled the country with arms and mines that have taken a human toll ever since. And for all we know, the grenade that brought down the helicopter was one that we left behind years and years ago because it was old style. We go in with the best of intentions. We don't do a great job of thinking about all the possible ramifications and options, and then we're stuck, and we pay a price for a long time. I would venture to say, and I'm not trying to second-guess the decision to go into Afghanistan. We had to do something about Al-Qaeda and about Osama. But now we're reaping what we sowed years ago and in the last 10 years. Who knows what's going to happen in Iraq.
It's important for the Afghani people to recognize the positive contributions that Americans have made. And as Charlie Wilson said, we sort of forgot to continue to reinforce that positive image to the Afghani people after the Soviets were forced out of Afghanistan.
But we were in no position at that time to get in there, stay there, help them evolve the central government.
Well, it was
government,
never a formal action by us.
Well, but I would respectfully disagree. I would suggest that we have the opportunity. I mean, USAID, and for those of you who are not familiar with it, it's the U.S. Agency for International Development. It is strictly a humanitarian and cooperative agency that brings in money, experts, supplies, funding for helping rebuild and reestablish infrastructure, help rebuild and establish a true solid government, and not so much government building, but it's government supporting, I guess is the right word. I think we had the opportunity with USAID to go in even back then. We didn't do it because Congress backed out of the funding. They thought we were done. The Soviet had lost. We'll go back to Cold War.
Big mistake.
I think what we have now is a situation where if we pull out without providing that sort of stated support, as in State Department, as in USAID, TDA, which is the Trade and Development Agency, we stand another chance of having another Taliban, Al-Qaeda-influenced government in the heart of an already destabilized region, namely the conflict with Pakistan, and the conflict with India.
And we can also involve other nations. It doesn't just have to be the United States. I mean, the Canadians, the Germans have been doing very well.
Absolutely.
We were also in there big time in the 50s, AID. We built dams, we built irrigation projects. They're all being used to irrigate poppies now. But they became, no, really, we have dams that are there. We have irrigation projects that were built in the 50s under AID when there was a king that are still operating and are still irrigating. That's what we have there.
There was a disconnect with the Afghan people.
They are there.
What I'm saying, though, is what we've seen as a result of the Russian invasion was a infrastructure that was inherently decimated by Russian military action. What we have now is the opportunity to help rebuild what we did in the 50s. I mean, look, at one time, you know, large American hotels and large economic development back in the late 40s, early 50s, after World War II, started flowing in. The Kabul Hilton was a premier hotel in the region. But now the Intercontinental Hotel was a premier flagship in the region. But now there's no sort of infrastructure because all that was originally decimated. Now it's been decimated even more because of Taliban rule. There's no set infrastructure for that country to survive without going back into the Stone Ages, in my opinion. Alan?
This whole conversation it reminds me that even after all these years, we're still not at a place where there's a lot of agreement about what we're doing, where we're going, how we'll get there. And an incident like the tragedy of earlier this week brings all that to the fore. It's interesting that we're talking about that because something even arguably much bigger, and I know you're going to turn to it, has swamped that news this week. And push this whole set of issues into the background still again.
It has, and it's unfortunate because, you know, we still to this day, and we're going to get to this, we're going to go to break here shortly, but, you know, we're going to talk about the big news, the economy. But the fact that, you know, 30 service members lost their lives, and traditionally, if you ask a lot of the service members that are in country that come back, they'll tell you there is a sense of we're doing good, we're doing the right thing over there. By, you know, and they're the ones that are there day to day actively working. You know, we don't hear the stories of good. We see the negatives. We don't see the stories of cooperative efforts between Afghanis and Americans and coalition forces. We see Taliban attacks. And until the media starts grabbing on to, hey, there's good things that are happening, whether it's getting medical attention to a family of children that desperately need it, or roaming dental clinics that go around the countryside, which have been done throughout our term in Afghanistan. Until that news gets back to mainland U.S., we're going to continue to have these debates.
I've heard this before. You know, we heard it from Vietnam. We're winning. We're gone. I respectfully don't agree. I don't think we should be there. I think we should leave.
We lost the PR war in Vietnam, but we won the battle.
We lost everything in Vietnam.
Well, we're going to let that be the last word on this subject. Again, everybody here at Backroom Politics here in Washington, our hearts, our prayers, and our thoughts go out to those service members who made the ultimate sacrifice for their country. It's never a good time whenever we have to talk about this subject, and it's something that we have to bring up from time to time. When we come back, We're going to talk about something that's probably going to garner a lot of debate here in the smoking crusted nerve center of backroom politics here at Shelley's Back Room. We're going to be talking about the economy, which continues to be a roller coaster. I'm getting motion sick just watching the stock numbers come in. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Stay with us. Radio from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. The roundtable today, we're going to be talking about the big ticket news item that's covering most of the media today and over the weekend is the economy. The fiscal crisis continues to baffle everybody. Congress and Washington politics continues to baffle everybody. The news today, the latest news today is that after a greater than 600 point drop yesterday, a basically $1 trillion loss to the stock market yesterday, the Federal Reserve announced today that they are going to keep the benchmark interest rate, quote unquote, at exceptionally low levels through at least mid-2013. As a result, the stock market has been up, it's been down, it's a roller coaster ride. It's up at
429
points today.
Yeah.
Almost taking a huge hunk out of the losses yesterday.
Well, wait till tomorrow.
Here's the thing is, the bell ends in a minute. I want to see what that looks like here shortly. But the reality is, this yesterday's loss was as a result of Standard & Poor's, a credit rating agency, one of the big three credit rating agencies that govern these type of reports, downgraded the American credit rating from AAA, its highest level, to AA+, which puts us in the same category as Belgium. I will tell you right now that has sparked a lot of discussion in the credibility that we give the credit rating agencies. Are they using the credit ratings as political gain, political mechanisms, political tools? The other big news coming out of yesterday was that Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner has decided he's going to stick it out and he's not going anywhere, which has got many in Washington scratching their head. Let's go first to the Standard & Poor's credit ratings. There are three major credit rating houses, those being Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and Fitch. I always miss Fitch. Fitch and Moody's have all maintained credit ratings of AAA for the U.S. government credit rating. Standard & Poor's downgraded. I'm going to go, Alan, to you. Did it shock you that it was only Moody's or only Standard & Poor's that went and downgraded, especially after they've been on TV saying, we're solid with it?
It surprised me that they went ahead, period, and it bothered me a lot. I thought it was a despicable move. Let's just review for a moment. These are the same guys who were giving AAA ratings to mortgage-backed securities a couple years ago. They were dragged in front, all three of them, in front of the Congress and ripped a new one, basically, for saying, what the hell were you guys thinking? And they were offended by getting raked over the coals. There were some new rules that came out of that. That's the backdrop here. Then these guys, months ago, weren't saying anything when the president was proposing a clean debt limit increase. Presumably back then, a clean debt limit would have been fine. Then the demands were made to have spending cuts and changes to reduce the long-term deficit, at which point Standard & Poor's stands up and says, we need it to be at least $4 trillion. Where's that coming from? No defense of that. Then we come up with the $2.5 trillion package, so-called. They bring their numbers to Treasury last Friday. Treasury looks at them and says, your analysis is off by $2 trillion. This was 2 o'clock on Friday, and they're going to announce on 5 o'clock in the afternoon. They go back and forth, agree that there's a $2 trillion mistake. Maybe there is $4.5 trillion, not that that's a magic number. What do? They have a phone teleconference, and 2 hours later at 5:15, they release their announcement and a press release that they've rewritten to not focus on the numbers, because the numbers were squishy, but to focus on the American political process, which they clearly don't understand. I thought it was unforgivable and really, really stupid. Having said that, there may be something good that can come out of this idiocy.
Well, let me ask this question. Bob, going off of what Alan said, is it fair, as some have called it, that the rating decrease by Standard & Poor's, was that a political move?
Yes. I think it was a political statement.
Is it being used? Is the credit rating of the United States by Standard & Poor's being used as a political tool?
It sounds to me as though that's about where they are. I mean, I think Alan is exactly right. They didn't know their own numbers, and they went ahead anyway. And all they're doing, they're basing it not on the numbers. They're basing it on they don't trust the political process. Well, they obviously don't understand, and they don't follow what's going on very well.
Well, John, you had a comment.
It's just weirder than weird that it takes Standard & Poor's to speak the truth about the American political system. And I might not know what they're talking about, but they said it is dysfunctional, and they were right. And other people should be saying it loud and clear.
Credibility. Hold on. Everybody hold on for a second. Ralph, go ahead.
Political gridlock. The U.S. is unable to put the right fiscal path plan in place. That has got S&P very, very nervous. And the U.S. debt plan has fallen short of what is necessary to get the U.S. back on the right track. As China would say, the good old days of borrowing are over. And they've actually come out in the press and said that.
Alan.
Yeah, I want to just take issue with my friend John when he says the system is dysfunctional. The system's a mess. But the system got the job done by the artificial date of August 2nd, which turned out not to be a real date. We could have had some extra time. I believe strongly, and we talked about this last week, that the president, that the White House had some options if they didn't cut a deal. the 14th Amendment option and some other things they might have done. We know they had a couple of extra weeks that they didn't want to use. Is it a messy process? Absolutely. But many of us felt very strongly that they were going to get this thing done. Now, what the better side, if there's a positive to what I thought was really an irresponsible and indefensible set of actions by them, what is that it was a wake-up call to Congress. They, you know, the Democrats are blaming the Tea Party and the Republicans are blaming the president. The fact of the matter is everybody in the system and the public, too, has some responsibility for the condition of our economy, bad decisions made, bad decisions in the law, bad decisions by individuals, and in the aggregate, helping put us at risk. So my hope is that when we realize that one entity can be a major participant in a disastrous drop in the Dow, a lot of uncertainty, this roller coaster ride that's making you seasick, that perhaps we will do more between now and the end of the year than we're scheduled to.
But Bob, I want to ask you, why Standard & Poor's? You would think that the credit rating agencies are looking at, and the analysts, you know, when they go on the analyst call that he talks about on Friday, the analysts are looking at the same data that everybody's looking at. Why Standard & Poor's? Why does Standard & Poor's have to make the decision, hey, you know what, that credit rating in the United States, they've got an issue?
They didn't have to make the decision. They didn't. They obviously didn't make it on the economic reality of it, because we are not as bad off as some of the countries that are. We have about the same debt ratio as Germany. Germany does.
Well, if you look at the numbers,
everybody says they're in pretty good shape.
Well, if you look at the numbers,
and only Standard & Poor's did it. There are two other rating systems which are have not weighed in on it.
That may
be more telling than anything else about how they think Standard & Poor's operates.
If you look at the numbers as they were put forward to all the credit rating things, and all the analysts had the same numbers, our debt to GNP is lower than the remaining top three AAA holders. It is significantly better than Belgium's. It is our 10-year debt race is better than including Great Britain, including Germany, including France, is better than those. Yet Standard & Poor's still is looking at numbers, and they're coming up with, it almost seems like magic math.
Well, what they're saying is there's a one in three chance the U.S. could get a second downgrade, but at the same time, S&P is saying, unlike other countries, the U.S. definitely can fix its problems and get its AAA credit rating back.
John.
First of all, Belgium is no longer a country. It's two countries.
Has been for years.
No, it's split a month ago. They're two countries. So I don't know whether you add two A's to one A and you get a AAA, or one A and an A and you get a AA. But Belgium's not a country anymore. They make great beer still, but it's not a country anymore. Secondly, I will never accept the fact, as long as I live, that Congress did the job by extending a debt ceiling in the way they did to create this hysteria when we shouldn't have that anyway. And if we do have it, it shouldn't be linked to all that other stuff. Thirdly, let's see how the special committee does and see what really turns out here. I don't really care about Standard & Poor's. I care about what Alan said in the first part of it, which is everybody's blaming everybody else. It's time to take a page from Walt Kelly and Pogo years ago, look in the mirror and say, we have met the enemy, whether you're a Democratic, liberal, or a Tea Party, we have met the enemy, and they is us.
Yeah, but here's the question I have for you, though. When you talk about this, when we talk about the $4 trillion as a number, $4 trillion was a number that was brought out in the Erskine-Bowles report, in the Simpson-Bowles committee report. That was a number that said, that was a magic number they said would get us to a point where we can get back to normal debt levels. But knowing the fact that they missed that mark in only doing $2.1 trillion instead of the $4 trillion that Bull Simpson brought out, which in Washington has largely been accepted as that should have been the blueprint we used in the fiscal crisis, we look at that number, does in fact Standard & Poor's have a legitimate complaint saying, hey, look, you guys, the blueprint that you guys said should be what you're using, you guys threw out the window. Alan?
Well, I like the Simpson-Bowles report. I think you're giving it too much credibility, though. This was a political process. You have guys from the left and the right who embraced it. Unfortunately, we didn't have a president who embraced it when he could have, when he should have.
We're here on that.
Yeah, we'll talk. We're going to talk about that in a second hour.
But it wasn't like that was the magic number. Remember, at the beginning of this, there was no magic number. It was, let's increase the debt limit again. Let's have a fight. Let's do what we've done in recent years. Have a close vote. Have people worry. President Obama, when he was a senator, voted against it. A lot of the Republicans have voted against them along the way. We've just never linked it to a bunch of other policy changes. But nothing magic about it.
But, John brings up the super committee, the Dirty Dozen, the Gang of 12, whatever you want to call them today. You know, are we putting too much power and too much influence over our economy into 12 individual members of Congress? Is that the solution, Bob?
It's the solution they've come up with. Now, I don't see anything wrong with a congressional committee doing it. I think it's a good idea. You know, Erskine Bowles was a good idea. They did
Simpson Bowles.
Simpson Bowles.
I got you doing it.
You got me doing it. I'm all over the place. But the fact of the matter is, they did a pretty good job. Now, why was it a good job? Because they were talking about both cuts on entitlement programs and raising revenues. And anybody in their right mind knows you're going to have to do both. Let's hope that the special committee is able to find a majority, which means that some members of both parties are going to have to loosen up their hardline positions. And let's hope we get there, because we have to do something by the end of the year, or we're going to have more or less indiscriminate cuts in both entitlement programs and in defense. And it's a very blunt instrument, and it's not a good instrument, but hopefully it's a strong enough instrument so that the committee will get beyond the talking points that each side has and try to figure out a way to do the right thing and take intelligent changes in our entitlement programs and intelligent ways to find revenue increases. And both Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson have pointed the way a little bit. There are other approaches. Alan Rivlin and Peter Peterson had something. And nobody on Capitol Hill who's been around a while doesn't know where there are ways you can fix both entitlements and raise revenues without blowing the system up.
Well, we're going to talk about that in a second hour, but I want to go back, John, to what you had said. You know, you mentioned, you know, I want to see what the super committee does. Are you, in fact, putting too much faith into the super committee, which some in Washington argue has no teeth?
I'd rather have them do it than Standard & Poor's do it.
Yes.
At least they're elected officials. At least they're both parties. It's way too much faith. I've said this on this program before. The most serious person on tax issues in the entire Congress is Dave Camp. He's on the House Ways and Means Committee. I'm a Democrat. He's a Republican. He's the guy that's going to get tax reform done. So lumping all of these things that used to be done by committees when they used to do their job into one committee and say they're going to do a grand plan, it sets us up for probably another fake number, another kicking can down the road.
Ralph.
S&P looks at the fact that the underlying debt burden of the U.S. is rising and continuing to rise, which injects further uncertainty into the markets. The S&P also sees a lot of fighting in Congress and nothing getting done. And they're very concerned that the U.S., at the end of the day, is not going to get their fiscal situation in order, which is why they've come out and said there'll be a second downgrade. But at the same time, there's a degree of optimism that the U.S. can get everything in order, looking at the U.S.'s relationship towards Europe and how closely tied we are with
Alan.
The U.S., you know, the Congress is a mess, but it muddles through. It muddled through this time. The Congress is changing. We got this divided government. We've got economic challenges that are unprecedented in sort of modern time. We sorted it out. This isn't the last word on all of this. We'd had step one, the immediate set of cuts. Step two is the super committee and what it's able to come up with, and there will be a vote on it, and if it doesn't get the votes, then we'll have automatic across-the-board cuts, or there will be some kind of other third-way solution. That's this step. we've got so much more to do regarding the deficit. We need to do more than $4 trillion. We started with 2.1 to 2.5, pick a number, it's in there somewhere. We've got a lot more to do, and that the, if there's anything good about this thing this week, which I think was, again, so irresponsible on the part of Standard & Poor's, it's that it did call, get everybody's attention, because nobody wants to be part of what we've seen this week in terms of the turmoil, the uncertainty, and the embarrassment. One last little point, if I might,
go ahead.
About this AAA business. There are 19 countries that have AAA rating, much of Europe, some of whom, like France, are really having trouble.
Yeah.
Now, what happened after all this? Did investors who were selling off in the market, did they take their money and go invest it in French government bonds?
They went to Treasury.
Right.
Let's talk about that for a second. You know, we look at all things considered, the one factor that we have not talked about, especially in the past couple of weeks, is the factor that came out today. That's Ben Bernanke and the Fed and the Fed's role in all this. The Fed comes out and says we're going to maintain unusually low credit rate or interest rates. On the market till mid-2013, a year and a half from now, that causes the stock market to jump up 420 points. Should Ben Bernanke have come out and said, look, you as Standard & Poor's, you as a legitimate international credit bureau, should have looked at all the numbers the way we looked at the numbers as the key financial institution.
No,
we
talked about that before. That's not Bernanke's role. That's Geithner's role. That is the role of the spokesman for this administration to say, that's not right. And I'd love to just give Alan Moore's talking points and say, here, Geithner, read it.
Well, Bob, is Geithner... Go ahead.
No,
I'm sorry.
But look at... Here, we're just talking about it. The market's going crazy. And... Where are people putting their money? In American treasuries, which are paying them a nickel.
Driving down the needle.
But it's amazing, though. And they're buying American bonds because no matter how bad the situation may be, it's still the best place to put your money.
Europe is much worse at this point.
But here's the question for everybody, though. Geithner announces he's staying. Doesn't affect the stock market.
Nobody wants it.
But Geithner stays. Well, it strikes me that, look, Tim Geithner has the ear of Wall Street. Or let me rephrase that. Wall Street has the ear of Tim Geithner. Tim Geithner was still the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. He was there in the center of the bull and bears. When he speaks, it doesn't affect the market. When we talk about Ben Bernanke says in a literally five-minute speech that we're going to keep interest rates low, stock market jumps up. It may not be the role of Ben Bernanke, but the markets aren't looking. The financial community isn't looking at what Tim Geithner does. It's looking at what Ben Bernanke does, and that goes back even back to the days of his predecessor. So, you know, when we look at the role of the Federal Reserve Bank, maybe it is the role of Ben Bernanke to help clean this up. Alan?
Just a word, a little different take on the Ben Bernanke piece. When he spoke, the market didn't go, all right, let's go. The market went down after he spoke because there were two messages that he gave. One, hang on, we're going to hold this firm into 2013. The reason we're going to hold down into 2013 is because this economy is in a shambles and it's going to stay there. Which, when people start thinking about, they think, what exactly is he telling us? So I think that the market went up not because of Bernanke. That was a factor. I think they concluded, we way overreacted yesterday. Time to correct. And it wasn't until late in the day that it climbed back up. It wasn't right after Bernanke. It was much later in the day.
Well, you know, one of the observations I got from somebody I know on Wall Street, he told me, he says, part of the problem, especially of yesterday, and what we're seeing today is there's two factors in play. One is the 24-hour. The media has just blown all this up, and they need it, and they hype it up into this huge financial disaster. Was it a financial Was it a financial burden? Yes, it was. But the media hasn't helped it. The other factor is, and it's kind of a little bit off subject, but it still plays into what we're talking about, is it ties into the Standard & Poor's downgrade, is that there's no more human factor analysis of the numbers. Everything's done off of a computer and computer models. Stock trades are done because a green light shows up and a red light shows up. They buy and sell off of computers. Is computer trading helping exacerbate the current problem, particularly in the stock markets? That's a question I have. You're kind of shaking your head, whether you don't know or you have a comment.
No.
Something to look at. But, Ralph, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's very important to recognize how critical Europe is to the U.S. The U.S. has about 25% of its exports in Europe. Half of the U.S. corporations are in Europe. And the driving force of earnings and profits of U.S. corporations come from U.S. corporations based in Europe. The interesting thing is, when Greenspan was on television a few days ago, he talks about $500 billion in liquid assets of corporations. How can you induce these corporations to put this money in long-term assets and job creation to help create jobs here in the U.S.?
Well, there's just in that subject, there's two very definitive. We could spend 2 hours on an entire broadcast on just the infrastructure debate, which we will do here in the next couple of weeks. But we're going to take a break here, and we're going to kind of flow into another topic is. Standard & Poor's came out publicly when it issued its downgrade into the U.S. rating and said this is a direct result of broken politics in Washington. We talked about it before, but we're going to spend the entire second half of this show today talking how dysfunctional is Washington politics, why is it so broken, and we talked about it before, but it's still something that resonates today is, can it be fixed, and what is it going to take to fix it? So with that in mind, we're going to take a quick break. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Stay with us.
Thank you.
we're back here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, the smoking, crusted nerve center of backroom politics. Joining me as they are, and because we got a huge topic coming up, I'm going to discard the usual bios. But roundtable: Alan, John, Bob, Ralph, and I'm your moderator, Justin. And we're going to go into a subject that was kind of brought to light by the Standard & Poor's downgrade. In their press release, when they downgraded the American credit rating from AAA to A+, and by the way, it's happy hour, so we're going to be ordering drinks here. Hey, Nasha, can I get my Jack and water, please? We're going to need some alcohol. We're going to need some alcohol for this discussion, kids. It is happy hour. Grab your martinis, grab your cigars. We're going to go deep now. Standard & Poor's in their press release said that the reason, a good chunk of why they did what they did, responsible or irresponsible, the reason why they did what they did was because Washington's broken. If Washington's broken, which we're hearing a lot of, it begs the question, one, why is Washington broken? And I pose the question to the roundtable. Bob, I'm going to start with you. Well, you're lighting a cigar right now because it is happy hour. John, I'm going to start with you while Bob lights up. Why is Washington broken?
Well, it's a deep, complicated, I'll say some things, so you know me, but, you know, conversation. And you know, it goes back to this whole thing. You know, it's a mess, it's awful, it's the worst thing in the world, but you wouldn't rather have any other system. But clearly, the deep partisanship, which frankly I think starts with the voters, with redistricting, with the media. You know, they say that conservatives get all their news on the radio, liberals get all their news in the newspapers. Just every way you can segment, we've segmented. Every way you can pull apart, we've pulled apart. Members don't live here anymore, as my good friend Bob Hines said. It's just all of these things together. But I heard a great quote the other day from Jack Valenti, and I think this is also very good. He said,
Jack Valenti, the former head of the MPAA?
The late
Jack Valenti.
I was coming to that. But yeah. What he said is, may the Lord help me spend all of my time with people seeking the truth and none of my time with people who have found it. In other words, everybody thinks they know the answer. Everybody thinks they're right. No single person is right. You know, we've got to figure out that we got to go through this together.
Alan, I'll go to you. Why is Washington broken?
Well, as you heard earlier, I'm not buying into that phrase that it's broken. I think it's all beat up and mangled and a mess, but it's also evolving and changing. And what worked 10 years ago is different now for some of the reasons that that John talked about. There's media, there's the nature of congressional districting and so on, and there's people who are absolutely convinced that they are right and nobody else is, and my way or the highway kind of thinking. But look what happened in this case. So what I love to remember about the deal that was struck, that Standard & Poor's thinks isn't worth anything, but I think it is. There were 87 freshmen in the House, almost all of whom were so-called Tea Party Republicans. Two-thirds of them supported the deal. And many of them, in explaining why, said because we have a better understanding of what all is involved and how this works. A third of them said, nope, not good enough. Well, so what does that mean for next time, for November? I don't know. All I know is we came up onto a deadline. We, not for the first time, but we've been doing it as long as I remember, got right up to the edge before we resolved everything. It was a mess. We weren't sure we were going to get there, but we did. And what works now is different than what used to work. We may be in a new paradigm where if we raise the debt limit, we got to do some other stuff. I like that? Not particularly, but if that's what we have to deal with, we will adjust. We will make that work.
Bob, going off of what Alan said, you know, there's some that are saying that Washington is so broken, it's going to take years of restoration to try and get back to where it was. There are some, like Alan, that are saying that it's not broken. It's the same process that's worked for the past 111 Congresses. The 112 is no different. Why? I go to you. Is Washington broken? And why?
No, it's bent. It's not broken. What it is we have a situation for a variety of reasons, which we can talk about in more detail, that are fundamental. What the problem is we have more members on both sides of the aisle, particularly in the House, which is much more susceptible to movement of the public because it's elected every 2 years. The senator has a little more time to go back home and explain things over the years, and people tend to forget. What's going on is we have in the House, we have a large, large number of Democrats who don't want to change Social Security as it is. Well, if we don't change it, we're dead. I mean, we have an unfunded liability of almost $80 billion. And we can't pay for that unless we change some kind of trillion. Is that trillion on the...
Trillion
with respect to Social Security. We got to work on some way. But the Democrats don't want to touch it. That's what they say. Republicans, on the other hand, say we're not going to raise any tax rates. Well, we have to have more revenue. There's no doubt about it. Anybody in their right mind knows we have to find more revenue. What we really need, and maybe Standard & Poor's and the market going crazy, maybe people on both sides that are so far left and so far right are going to begin to see that there has to be a coming together of people who will say, look, I don't want to blow Social Security out of the water, but I recognize there have to be some changes. And the Republicans can be saying, look, we don't want to raise money willy-nilly, but we're willing to do some things that will bring revenues in, revenues enough, so that with the changes in some of our entitlement programs and some more revenues, we'll be able to raise the kind of money we need to run the government, be more efficient, hopefully, and get out of this fix we're in. All it takes is the same people who are here just to recognize that just you can't take a pure position on any issue in dealing this problem. You're going to have to make changes in entitlement programs. You're going to have to raise revenues. There is no doubt that both sides have to come to a conclusion that they both have to give something up. And if you can't leave it the way it is. You can't leave it the entitlement programs the way they are, and you can't leave the revenue side the way it is. You have to change both.
Ralph. Ralph, I'm going to ask you the same question we asked the other members, is why is Washington broken?
If you consider Washington to be broken, it's because when a member, a newly elected member of Congress comes to Washington, he's not encouraged to work across party lines and to bring people together to solve problems. You get points within your own party for demagoguing the other side. Bob is exactly right. We need to bring people from the far left and the far right together to solve these issues. American people are getting fed up and angry, and they want America to be put back on the right track. And the only way to do that is to come together and work to solve these problems.
But we've seen, and we've talked about this on the show before, but it's been especially prevalent over the past few days. There is a definitive lack of what we would call inherent leadership. The Standard & Poor's announcement comes out, and President Obama is out at Camp David, doesn't say anything. We get some sound bites out of the Capitol that really doesn't amount to, dare I say, putting faith in the American people back into the way that they are governed. Is there a leadership vacuum, Alan, that we're missing here in Washington?
I don't know about a vacuum. Maybe a deficit is the right word. I think that this president was handed a very bad hand, and I don't think he's played it very well. And sometimes he's also the victim of bad luck. You think about the last week and a half. We get a big deficit resolution, so to speak, that's going to buy us some time. He's got a 50th birthday party and a bunch of fundraisers come up, and then this horrible tragedy in Afghanistan occurs, and then he's off celebrating his 50th birthday. Well, is he supposed to cancel all of that? No, but that was a bad juxtaposition. Then this idiotic move by Standard & Poor's that we're trying to find something good in, and maybe there will be some, occurs on a Friday afternoon when he's heading off to Camp David, and it's not as though there was some brilliant thing he could go out and say, but he goes off and then he gets hammered for disappearing. Leadership deficit. We got a bunch of leaders. There's no clear person we all look to and respect, and there's no Walter Cronkite in the news business. It's the president is the best we got. We got to make the best use of it. I think this president gets just barely a passing grade, and I think that's a problem.
John, I'm going to go to you as one of the Democrats at the table. We've heard comparisons of, well, the only Democrat today, we've heard comparisons of, and I've said this many times, President Obama's administration is almost point for point mirroring the administration of Jimmy Carter. There's not a clear message. He's being too academic. There's not a clear stroke of leadership. There's some that says that, there's some here in Washington that say that when the Standard & Poor's announcement came out, George W. Bush would have been right there on the TV saying, "You're idiots." Is the comparison to what happened in the 70s under the Clinton, under the Carter administration, is that a fair assessment of what's going on currently in the Obama administration?
No, not in any way. If you want to, and to say that Bush would have come out and done it better is just, that doesn't go anywhere. I mean, it just doesn't work. It doesn't happen. And it's not a particularly high bar. I think that we have a leadership problem with this president. I've agreed with that. But if you want to go back, let's go back to Jimmy Carter, because that's a, you know, the only one who stands out of the crew since Jimmy Carter for having a clear, defined agenda and an ability to stick with it and articulate it is Ronald Reagan. Whether Democrats like it or not, Clinton found his way to leadership, and he particularly near the end of his term, after, you know, being baptized by fire and the government closure of 1995 and other issues like that. I still have hope for this president. He's smart, you know, he gets it, he wants to do better. He was dealt a terrible hand, although I'm kind of about done with that as an excuse, to tell you the truth. I'm about at the end of that being an excuse. But, you know, it is true, and these are the times where we're going to see what his leadership is, and you know what comes out and how he does. But I don't think the verdict's in.
Well, the American people expect Obama to lead, and he's going to have to go out there and give Congress hell like Harry Truman did in the late 40s to get the country on the right track. People expect this from President Obama.
Now, going back to John, what you were saying, what you were saying was, it's not fair, basically, and I'm going to paraphrase, it's not fair to compare the Jimmy Carter administration to the Obama administration, and I respectfully disagree, but to defend President Obama, what we don't have that we had in 1979, because we're hearing a lot of those same arguments from 79 today, we don't have four-hour gas lines, we don't have
18% inflation.
18% inflation, we don't have double-digit unemployment, which we had in 79 under the Carter administration. But defending the president that way, it seems that every time his lack of leadership comes out, or every time that the American people just are clamoring for somebody to show leadership out of the White House, we teeter on the possibility of going back to big inflation, big unemployment numbers, and four-hour gas lines, at least in the memory of those who were inside Washington.
If you want to, I think Ralph wants to get in here, but if you want to, you know, say what's similar, they both came in as outsiders. I know he was a senator for a while, but he was still an outsider. They both ran as not establishment. They're both very, 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 very smart, and they probably both tried to do too much themselves. Neither of them are very good at delegating.
Very academic.
Okay, but they didn't delegate, and see, what we need to replicate on the domestic side is what he's done by inheriting Bob Gates, who I think is a true American hero, by the way. You know, where those guys run things over there, he needs to have the same strong people on the domestic side, and he doesn't have them, and he hasn't had them. That's very much like President Carter in terms of the delegating to strong people for economic and domestic policy.
But
we look
at the relationship. I mean, we look at the relationship that Carter had with a very strong presence in his administration, even on domestic issues, and that in Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. Kissinger was a very close ally. Secretary of State under
Cyrus Vance.
Cyrus Vance. there's a close relationship between Cyrus Vance and Jimmy Carter, even on some of the domestic stuff. The question
he resigned over the failed rescue attempt of the hostages.
Right. But when we look at, and it was Jimmy Carter that went to him and said, look, does this thing work? And it was Cyrus Vance who actually said, yeah, we can make this, you know, we can make this happen. The question I pose is, looking back at that, I guess the question now is President Obama, does he have the experience or is he capable of demonstrating the type of leadership that ultimately comes from experience? Bob?
He's a very bright guy, and he tends to be more passive than I think we might like as a president. Instead of, well, let's talk about this last few months, you know, the budget problem. He apparently, in private, when he was negotiating with the speaker, he was talking about, and he made proposals to the speaker about what he would give, if what the Republicans would give. But he has never gone on television and said, this is what I'm willing to give. He has never got out and said, this is my program, this is my idea. And it's a question of aggressive leadership that he fails to have. The same was true when, on the health care program. I mean, he basically said, I want a health care program, and I really am interested in it, and he pushed for it quietly. But really, he let the Democrats in Congress create the health care program, pretty much. And it's just, you know, he's willing to let other people, you know, do the grunt work, and he doesn't, when he doesn't speak out, it's hard for the American people to know what's going on and where he is. By definition, the president has the bully pulpit. He does not use the bully pulpit as most presidents have in the past. I will give you an example. Remember welfare reform, and this is a perfect example, I think, because you found the Republicans, relatively new in power, Gingrich in the speakership, and they found a way. They found a way between Mr. Clinton and the Republicans in the Congress, they found a way to put together a pretty damn good welfare reform program. And it has been working. We have fewer people on welfare, we have a lot of good programs working, and things work pretty well. That's the kind of leadership we need in a president. And I'm not, you know, and I think Bill Clinton was a very, very successful politician in a way he was able to get out and lead a little bit. And I think we could use a little bit more of that.
Rob. Right. I think if Obama really wants to lead, he can put together a comprehensive plan for education and infrastructure in the U.S., like China and India have undertaken. China's already invested 9% into infrastructure, Europe 5%. The U.S. needs to start committing a comprehensive plan for education and infrastructure. If you look at us on the international scene, we're only 14th in reading and 25th in math. How are we going to compete with China and Russia in the next millennium?
I agree with everything you said. I have no idea how we're going to do that in this climate, because you are right. It's what we need to do, and that means spending some money.
Yeah.
And that means raising some revenue.
Yeah.
Well, I dare say we spend a lot more on education per capita in this country than any of these other countries you're talking about.
But it's
we
not
just
going
don't do it
right
very
area.
Well.
Right.
Well, it's not just the schools. It's
yeah.
not just the schools.
Well, that's right.
Well, let's go back for this segment.
That's a good infrastructure.
Let's go back and talk for this segment though about, you know, what we're talking about, what's broken in Washington, and is there inherent, I don't want to use the word fault, but inherent culpability in part of the quagmire that's happening inside D.C. these days? Is there a culpability that can be placed on the White House and the way it operates going from day one till now? John?
Well, not any more than anybody else.
No.
Bob?
Not fair.
I think the president should have been more aggressive in the last 2 years on a variety of issues, which he hasn't done. But it's also true, I mean, we've had a Congress, particularly in the House, where you got a bunch of liberals who won't touch anything that's called an entitlement, and you've got a bunch of guys in the House, the Tea Parties, who won't touch anything it's called tax increases. Now, you know, you can argue for purity all you want, but listen, I hate to go back to the Founding Fathers, but by God, they created a system of government that was not going to be easy to make decisions, because every interest was going to be involved. Big states against small states. You know, all kinds of structures within the Constitution that says we're going to have to be able to work together. And the whole damn thing requires a willingness of both sides to find a middle ground that they can both live with.
But, you know, just,
and they don't do it.
Alan, you know, we look at, you know, the famous quote, if we don't look at history, we're destined to repeat it. There's a certain inherent liability in that statement that says there's a lot in history we could learn that we actually do want to repeat, which includes a lot of the subjects that we're talking about, the ability of the White House to work with Congress as part of a tricameral government. The ability to
that one's for Al.
well, he's with us in spirit.
Al's with us in spirit. A martini was displaced in his.
If he knew that there was a martini waiting for him, he'd do anything.
He'd be here. I know he'd be here. Let me go back to Alan. Alan, you know, when we look at that, it almost seems like America is asking us to go back to history and say, why don't we have a president that can work with Congress? Why don't we have Congress that will work with themselves? Should we go back and look at the history books and look at how maybe the first Congress or the 24th Congress may have done things and repeat it?
I don't think that's going to tell us very much, frankly. As we've talked about before, the whole system has evolved and evolved and evolved. I think more recently, though, and you were talking about history repeating itself, if we don't learn from it, when President Clinton was elected, his successful focus was, it's the economy, stupid.
Right.
Now, along comes Obama, the economy is in a shambles, he gets elected, the first thing out of the box that has to get resolved is all the spending bills left over from 2008 that the Congress didn't get done. What does he do? He says, Congress, fix it. He does not take advantage of that opportunity. That laid out a template that he has followed ever since. He gave that, he deferred to the Congress on that first set of cleaning up the 2009 spending. He deferred way too much to the Congress on designing the stimulus package, where there was all this talk about shovel-ready projects. Nothing about merit. Well, it turns out we're ignoring, in many ways, merit, and nothing was shovel-ready, but we spent
a lot of stuff was shovel-ready. You didn't put the money there.
We spent hundreds of billions of dollars.
The problem with the stimulus was delivery systems, and nobody focused on that.
Well, let's go back.
But there was an enormous amount of deferral, again, to the Congress. And then he took his eye, in my mind, off it's the economy's stupid ball, which, my gosh, if he's going to complain constantly about the crappy hand he got, then that's where your focus has got to be. The focus is what was on a health care reform bill where there was not a political consensus on what to do and how important it was to do. And there was, an enormous amount of deferral of judgment to the Congress. So what do we end up with? A sea change in the 2010 elections, and he's bearing the fruit of that now. So I'm not saying it's all his fault. I'm saying he has an enormous piece of the responsibility. Then he's got all kinds of difficulties now with the Republican Congress.
Bob, I'm going to give you the last word for this segment.
I couldn't agree with Alan more, and I think everybody at the table agrees with just that. We needed a president who was focused on jobs. We needed a president who was focused on the economy, and he didn't focus on it either by leading or setting that agenda and speaking out about that agenda. And it's still the same agenda. And he just is not a focused, strong leader in that area. And it's just his style. And it may work in another time in another place, but right, it's the wrong style of leadership. He has not seize the economy as the issue and worked at it, focused, right, constantly working at it day after day, month after month, not letting people focus on other things. And he let the other Democratic leaders, you know, push their, as Alan says, the health care. Now, I'm not saying health care was wonderful, before he did his bill. We don't know how it's going to work out. It's still a couple of years away from being fully implemented. But the fact of the matter is, we didn't need to do that first. We needed to worry about the economy first. We needed to worry about how to keep jobs going, how to build more jobs, and we didn't do it.
Well, that's going to lead us into our next item, because if we think that the White House has got an issue, the big problem that everybody's calling for is the one institution in Washington that has a low double-digit approval rating, and that's Congress. When we come back, we're going to talk about, is Congress broken and why, and possibly how we can fix it. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Stay with us.
What's the next one?
And we're live back at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, right in the middle of happy hour. You can hear the glasses clinking. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. Joining us as they are usually is the gang of, well, we like to call them the gang of six, minus one today. Al is a no-show today. But we were talking a little bit, and we're talking for this whole hour, about a subject that was brought to light, namely by the Standard & Poor's credit rating downgrade of the U.S. government from AAA to AA+. In their statement, when they announced the downgrade, they said that in part they are doing this because Washington is broken. And we've decided to look at the question of, one, is Washington broken? And two, if it's broken, how do we fix it? In the last segment, we were talking about the president and the White House, about some of the responsibility it has to help maybe fix some of the problems here in Washington. But now we're going to talk a little bit about the subject that has gotten low double-digit approval ratings in the eyes of the general public. It is largely in many circles to blame for a lot of what's going on here in Washington, and that's Congress. Congress at one time used to be a bastion of negotiation deals, relationship building, and now it's just become almost a battlefield of venom and demagoguery. When, Bob, you spent a lot of time in Congress, around Congress, I should say. You were never a member.
Thank God.
You were smart in some instances. When we look at people putting blame on Congress as far as being the true catalyst for a lot of the problems that we're seeing here in Washington, is that fair, or is it right now in today's Congress, in today's political climate, accurate?
Well, I don't know if the word fair is right, but I would say, why would you think anything else, given the last year or so when Congress has been unable to do so many things? I mean, we don't have the kind of ability in Congress at the moment to negotiate rather than just talk past each other. Everybody has both parties have their talking points, and everybody has their ideological political views. And the problem is nobody is willing to say, I'll bend over here if you'll bend over there to the other side. And the problem is very simple. I mean, now, we've seen these kind of problems in the past, but this is probably as worse as I have seen it in my experience, and I suspect possibly that John and Alan would say much the same thing. It's never been so, my way or the highway. And that isn't just the Tea Party. It's everybody. I mean, the Democrats say they want to save Medicare as it is. That's impossible. Fundamentally impossible, unless you would take double the tax rates. If you didn't touch anything else, the only way to solve Medicare is double the tax rates. That's what you'd have to do. You can't do that kind of stuff. You have to find ways to come together and solve the problems by everybody in Capitol Hill understands the way to fix Social Security is to touch about three or four different parts of it and take a little bit of a nickel out of everything so nobody loses the right arm. They maybe lose a couple of digits on a finger. But nobody is willing to make those kind of deals right now. That's the problem. Now, and that goes beyond Social Security. It goes to everything else. When the Republicans say, the Tea Party people say, we will not see any tax rate increases, that's probably an impossible situation if you want to balance the budget. Alan?
Go ahead.
I just feel a duty to point out that our buddy Bob, who is my longtime buddy, has just said he totally rejects the notion of pushing Grandma over a cliff, but he doesn't mind cutting off a couple of Grandma's fingers.
Oh, God.
Well,
look,
and
but
I suspect Grandma wouldn't care.
But in fairness, Grandma would say, if I got to give up my pinky, if everybody else gives up something, then I want to do that too because I care about my grandchildren.
Yeah.
The grandchildren are the missing voice.
Well, but I go back, Alan, I go to you. You also have been around Congress for many years. You've seen in its heyday in success, in its heyday of even today, some would say abject collapse. When we look at, is Congress to blame for a lot of the problems that we're dealing with today? Is that a fair assessment?
You know, I say yes, but not for the kinds of things that people are talking about.
Why? Then why?
Let's go back to the root cause of what we've been dealing with in recent years, and it's a mindset fostered by law, which means by federal law, including the Congress, that you can have a free lunch. You can have a bigger house than you can afford. You can have a bigger car and a newer car than you can afford, and newer furniture than you can afford, and everything's going to be fine, and your 401k is going to continue to increase, and we have this legal structure that was insupportable, and the public, as John Freshman said earlier, they bought in. Why not?
Well, wait a minute. Let me ask this question, though. So what I'm hearing from you, and correct me if I'm wrong, it almost sounds like you're saying that the concept of Congress going to the Hill, members going into the floor with the idea of, I am here to promote the American dream, is part of the problem of what we're dealing with now?
It's part of the problem when it says, I support the American dream, and it's free for everyone.
But you
don't have to save for it. You don't have to exert any significant discipline. And we created a set of rules and a set of expectations, particularly around home ownership, that made no sense, and we're all guilty, and we're all suffering
how,
now.
How can members of Congress say they're promoting the American dream when they can't really relate to the people they claim to represent? You look at the U.S. congressional salary, it's $174,000. That's equal to four times the average wage of a full-time American worker, the second most generous in the world behind Japan. Is this pay worth the performance that they're putting out? I would say no. They failed miserably, and American people are getting fed up.
John, you want to tap into that, I know.
I don't think the salary's relevant.
I think
that what we have is people that have just come here and they think they know what the American dream is, or they think they know what people want, or they think they know how to do jobs, or they think they know how to do entitlements, and they don't know yet.
But
I think we need more experience, not less. I think we need people to be here longer, not shorter.
But Bob, let me ask a question. Wow, which is funny because looking at the CNN right now, and we missed that. Voters steal Congress a stunning blow. 49% say members do not.
Big difference.
Does not deserve re-election, which
right.
is huge, because that means that in the coming election, incumbency may not mean squat. That's a huge, huge number.
Right.
That's a huge blow to Congress. But that ties into my question to you, though, Bob. Is the process broken, or is it the people that are broken?
Well, the process of elections and redistricting and things of that nature helps to, and you know, the media and all the rest of it, helps to give us a Congress which is very, very ideologically divided. And we have people who are, as John has said, we need some more experience. We have a whole lot of new members. It'd be one thing if instead of having, you know, 85 new members in one party coming in and changing the structure, the mental structure of the Congress, if you will. What happens is it's very hard. You already have a Democratic caucus in the House, which is made up of probably 60% of people who are very, very liberal. Nothing wrong with that. And you've got a House on the Republican side, which has a huge influx of brand new members who, for a lot of them, have never served as a public official before. And that's pretty unusual. We have an awful lot of business people and other enough professional people who ran because they were so aggravated at the way things were going. They won because of the mood of the public. But they have to learn, like any member has to learn, you can't get everything you want your way. You have to be willing to cut deals. And it's very hard for these brand new members to understand that they have to do that. Maybe the activity of the last couple of weeks and the way the market has dived down for them, the way we had Standard & Poor's, if they didn't do anything else, they got people's attention. And so maybe people are going to come back after the recess, and they maybe ought to be called back earlier, but at least maybe some people are going to beginning to think, you know, I can't have 100% of what I want, but I'll take 65% or 75%. As long as the other guys will give something, I'll give something. Nobody wants to give first.
John.
An example I use a lot. We have a brand new Senate, and I like to use Republican examples, being the House Democrat. We have a brand new senator from Ohio. His name is Rob Portman. He has been on the staff of the White House. He's been the head of OMB. He's been the special trade representative. He's been a member of the United States Congress from Cincinnati. I would take that whole 12-man special committee and say, Rob, you are it. We need people like that who have been out there in the world who've solved this problem. It's the best hope for tax reform. I use him a lot, too, because he's a great guy. He's a guy named Dave Camp from Michigan. He's been here for 12 or 14 years. All he focuses on, all he cares about, every day when he wakes up, talk about single message, Alan, you know, being consistent, is tax reform. Not tax increases, not tax cuts, tax reform. We need to broaden the base. We need to lower the rates. People who are experienced know that.
But I go to the point, though. You know, we look at people like Senator Portman. But then I look at people like Senator Hatch, who has been largely seen as somebody who can cross the aisle, make deals happen, and that he has to make votes, and this is conjecture, but a lot of people believe that he voted against the finance reform bill because of the fact he is scared for his seat in Utah.
Well, he should be. 2 years ago, Bob Bennett, who was a splendid guy, did not, by his own admission, fell asleep in the primary. This is Bob Bennett talking, not John Freshman for him.
Right.
Fell asleep in the primary and got beat. I think Hatch and Lugar are wide awake to that threat. Nobody's going to sneak up on those guys again.
But can I say,
Bob,
I want to make a note of something. John just mentioned two names of members of the House who are the kind of people who ought to be on that super committee. They're both Republicans. There are Democrats in the House who have in the Senate who have the same broader view. I mean, Kent Conrad, the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, is exactly that kind of a person.
Mark Warner.
Yeah, Mark Warner is another one. Those are the kind of people who we need more of, if only because they are willing to find middle ground. It may not be the ground a lot of the extremists on each end would pick, but it's the kind of ground we're going to have to find if we're going to solve our problems.
It seems to me, and Alan, I'll go to you. You spend a lot of time involved in the Senate. When we talk about this, it almost seems to me that we're hearing that the problem is the people, but we also see almost a certain complacency out of members of Congress. Anytime that there's a difficult issue, you know what, we'll form another committee. We've had committees after committees, whether it's the Gang of Six or the Bull Simpson group, many, many committees have been formed, and it seems like all we did in this last fiscal go-around was create not just any committee, but a super committee, a committee on steroids.
Well, we've had some sort of super committees for a long time. When we created in 1976, in the 74 in the Budget Act that created the budget committees, that was the first sort of super committee, and from the budget process grew something called reconciliation. It's a very complicated procedure, but it's been the key to getting a lot of very tough legislation done. Outside committees,
it only requires a majority of the Senate.
That's right. And we were faced with a major Social Security challenge in 1982-83. How did we do that? Inside Congress? No. We created a special committee on Social Security. Who was the chair? Alan Greenspan. What happened as a result of that? We increased the retirement age, and we increased the tax structure for Social Security. We bought ourselves a lot of time. So it doesn't offend me that we create outside groups, special groups. The Congress itself has got particular challenges, rules of openness and transparency. They don't get to come down here and sit in the back room, the cigar-filled room. They have to be out there in the sunshine, and they have to posture for the public. And sometimes it's difficult to make these hard compromises in public. That doesn't trouble me at all that there are some things that happen behind the scenes.
But Bob, we look at, you know, hearing what Alan's saying, you being a longtime noted, I'm trying to find the word that doesn't overplay you. I mean, in all a known resource of expertise in House floor parliamentary procedure. Wow, I got that one good.
Say that twice.
I couldn't even repeat it just now. Look. Bottom line is, you know about floor procedure, you know how the process in Congress, particularly the House, works. Is it a matter of that we have to go back to basics and revisit exactly how they vote, when they vote? Do we have to go back? The idea of having a budget go to each of the floors, then go to conference, then go to reconciliation, then go back for floor vote, do we have to go back and look at the way that Congress does business internally?
No. No, we don't. We don't have to work. The internal systems of the Congress are set up because they work best that way. What we need are the kinds of people who can use those opportunities to find solutions. It takes a long time. It's not easy. It's not easy for anybody to say, I'm going to come off my viewpoint absolutely and move a little bit. It's hard to do that. You've got pressures from back home. You've got pressures from your supporters. You've got pressures from your fundraisers. It's hard to do that. But you're going to have, all we need to do is not have a bunch of whole different people. We just have the need to have the people we've got now understand what it takes to get to a solution, which means everybody has to give something. They can't get everything they want. And we now have a situation in the House of Representatives particularly, which both sides are very dug in on their points of view. And they're very, and legitimately so from their standpoint. But they still have to find a way to give some ground, to give something up in order to get something from the other side. And both sides have to find out the fact that they have to be willing to give something and go back home and say, I did it because we had to get a deal done, and it's a reasonable compromise. Well, the word is compromise.
Well, let me go there. We have two people on our round table of pundits that served in committee staff on the Senate. And the procedures somewhat similar. You know, the committee staff and the committee process is very similar on the House and the Senate with certain variations. But I go to you, John, and you, Alan, and ask the question, do the committees themselves inherently have too much power to drive what normally could have been done in old times on the floor in straight-up debate and straight-up vote, or do we need to revise the committee process, basically? John, I go to you first.
Can I say something quickly off of Bob before I do it? We do tend to criticize the leadership of the president and the speaker because they've been the key players in this latest problem.
They're the one with the biggest targets.
The fact is, they've tried hard to do the right thing. And I think $4 trillion is just a number, but I think balancing entitlements and revenues was the important factor, and they both tried to do it, and they didn't get it done. Well, you could call that a failure of leadership. You could call it a failure of followership. I don't know. With respect to the committees, the Senate is completely different than the House. As one congressman said to the one Democrat congressman in front of me talking to his Republican colleague said, you're the opposition. The Senate is the enemy. And I've heard that more than once. The Senate's, I don't think it's the committee structure. I just think the Senate is the Senate. And there I align with my good friend Alan, battered, beat up, but kind of doing what it's supposed to do, which is to slow stuff down.
Well, Alan, do you agree with John? Is the committee process the way it should be and continue it on? Or do we look at maybe reforming the way?
No, every time we try to reform, we waste a lot of time, and we end up with a new structure that sort of falls back to the same thing. When there's a really important issue that comes forward, the committee may play a major role, but oftentimes it seeps up to the leader's office. It happens more in the House, but increasingly in the Senate, you'll find the Senate Majority Leader and the Senate Minority Leader sort of grabbing things into their office to say, here's how it needs to be. It's a delicate matter, especially in the Senate, because every individual senator has so much power, so much ability to muck things up on the floor of the Senate, where any senator can get recognized and talk for as long as he wants. That's something that does not happen in the House. But I am not a believer in some kind of major restructure. Every time we talk about a major restructure or changing the so-called filibuster rules or trying to fight this business that it takes 60 out of 100 votes to get something really important, and that's somehow horrible and counter to the framers' intent, the Constitution, I don't buy it. I think you adjust to it, you can make it work. We made it work this time. Oh my God, it was a mess. And there were people were beaten and bruised, but it worked.
Bob. The fact of the matter is, this country is 235 or so years old under the Constitution and under the rules we've got. It has worked. It has worked because of the people. The rules, you know, are the rules. and they're structured different in the House and the Senate because of the different structure of the bodies and the way they are. The Senate has always been the saucer, you know, that cools the hot structure of the House, as the founding fathers thought it would
Federalist
do.
Federalist 10, please.
Yeah. There it is.
Wow.
We're talking about the fundamental structure of the government. And I think that the question is not, do we need to change the rules of the structure of the government? What we need to do in the Congress is we have to make sure that the members of the Congress understand their responsibilities and understand how things get done. And it's very hard when you have very strong ideological groups in both bodies, particularly in the House. It's very hard for them to loosen up a little bit and to give a little bit. And they're learning slowly but surely. And it takes a while. But the biggest problem we may have this time is we have so many freshman Republicans that are the core, you know, that have a very strong view. And the Democratic caucus in the House has been slimmed down substantially. And a lot of the moderates were defeated in the last election. And so the strength of the Democratic caucus in the House is very, very liberal, as the caucus in the House for the Republicans is very, very conservative. And they're having a hard time figuring out that they got to start talking to each other.
Well, and at the end of the day, American people want compromise. They want solutions.
They want
a
solution.
All right, Alan, go ahead.
I just want to say one thing. You know, the results of last November's elections were a big surprise. Maybe not a sea change, but a pretty big surprise that the Republicans won. They won with a big majority. They had all these so-called Tea Party people, bunch of new, inexperienced folks. They came to town. How do you deal with that? How do you integrate that into the system?
Yeah, there you go.
Making a long time.
Stuff. We're expecting these brand new guys who got elected saying we're going to cut spending to suddenly be great statesmen who understand the history of the country.
You know,
no, they're slowly getting there. Give them some time.
Hold on, John.
Before we lose the Senate question and the rules that you asked, I want to just tell you the thing I'd like to see more than anything else in the Senate, and I have seen many, is a real, honest-to-God, actual filibuster where some guy has to stand there and hold the floor. The last one was Senator Al D'Amato on a trade rule regarding Brothers typewriter. I had something in another bill that I was trying to find a little opening on the floor, which I did. I sat up all night because I'm a junkie for politics. And finally, you know, at 4 o'clock in the morning, he ran out of gas. He gave up the floor. The leadership seized it. It was over. Instead, all you have to do is say, I'm thinking maybe someday I might possibly consider an aspect that could be called a filibuster in another place. And everybody runs away and says, oh, no, don't bring up this bill. This is awful. Oh, my God, we can't do it.
Well,
I've had a real filibuster.
That brings up
Rob
a subject.
Thurman.
Yeah. Well, that brings up the subject that we talked about before early on in the creation of backroom politics, and that is the filibuster, in fact, is part of the problem inside the U.S. Senate, and
they don't
hurdle
filibuster. Well, they don't filibuster.
Not
a
traditional
the problem with the
filibuster. Stand and talk to you. Run out of gas.
The problem with the filibuster rule is that they're not filibustering anymore.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to filibuster. All you got to do is raise your hand and say, "Well, I'm gonna talk
Maybe.
About this."
You know, it's funny because you know we talk about the filibuster. You know, we look at when we see a filibuster, and a lot of people today they see a filibuster it's just saying, "Okay, I filibuster." As opposed
you
to
ought to be my age to have ever seen one.
Yeah. Well, but the great thing about it is, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington is playing on TCM this year.
Awesome.
Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and that was a true filibuster. That's a filibuster that we're talking about versus the threat of a filibuster, which doesn't work.
Well, why were the rules changed to prevent something like that from happening?
They were changed.
They weren't changed.
Well,
no.
What happened?
They weren't changed.
No.
Go ahead. You and your author.
Okay.
Here again.
I mean, yeah.
We never changed.
These things evolve, and you can't anticipate everything that's going to occur. People threaten to debate. As long as it's a meaningful threat, and it's been proved that these threats are meaningful, that's why they're acknowledged and worked around. When the Senate filibusters, they look like idiots. They're on television, they're standing there, one person's talking to an empty room, people are in cots, sleeping out in the Capitol.
they all look like idiots.
As opposed
they,
to now.
They all decide, you know something? We don't need to put the health of our elderly guys at risk, keeping them up late all night, and we don't need to look just totally stupid. Let's go work it out.
Let's find
now,
a different way to look stupid.
Well, that, you know, it's a different matter, but I think anybody who says make them talk, believe me, the leaders on both sides have wrestled with this, considered this, and they've decided they mean it when they say they're going to filibuster, and we all lose because we all look really stupid. I'm not saying they look smart when they do something else, but they know they look stupid.
Bob.
Example. Now, here, we have 87 new Republicans.
Right.
That is a sea change. Now, if it was only 20 Republicans or 30 Republicans coming in, they would have been assimilated much easier into the body of the caucus. They wouldn't have been such a huge group. But so it would have been more difficult for them to bond together and say, by God, this is the only way to go. Now, what happens is, if let's assume for the moment that in the next election, maybe those 87 might get, you know, mostly defeated, and we might get, you know, 60 new liberal Democrats. We would have just as much trouble. We'd have just as much trouble on the other side, saying, by God, we're going to do our way or the highway, because they're brand new, they don't know the system. And when you have a body of members that are brand new, that large in one party, it's hard for the existing membership of the party caucus to help them understand that you can't just have it my way or the highway. You do have to let some other cars on the road.
Well, you know what? You brought up the subject. You know, you talk about the 87 and the possibility of a brand new alternate 87 coming in 2012. Because the current 87 will be ousted, that brings up the question of term limits. Oh, you know what? We'll say that for another show, because we're coming out in the last 7 minutes of Backroom Politics.
One thing to say, I'm not suggesting that I want to see the 87 get defeated. What I want to see them get, like any group of freshmen, liberal, conservative, whatever, I want to see them understand how the process works best when people come together and try to find solutions rather than say my way or the highway.
In other words, freshmen should act like freshmen.
Well, they ought to pay a little attention to some of their elders who have been around.
Or as a former speaker said, they should be seen but not heard.
Like,
but
oh,
they came,
wow.
Happened to be a great guy from the state of Washington. I'll let y'all figure
there
it
out.
There
we go. People came to Washington under the assumption they were going to change how things were done.
Exactly. Well,
so they're not going to do that.
Well, I'll tell you what. Right now we're coming down to the end of Backroom Politics. We're coming down to the last 5 minutes. This is our free-form session. This is my favorite. It is all conjecture. It is all rumor. It is all hearsay. It is our ability to scoop all the other media outlets. And it is tell me a story. And, Alan, you have a story?
Well, who knows? I'm so ticked off, as you now know, at Standard & Poor's, and I'm still seeking a silver lining. And because I'm such a rosy-cheeked optimist, I'm going to predict that when we get to the super committee and into next year, we're going to do more in long-term deficit reduction than the $1.5 trillion target, not less.
Wow. Good one. John, you got one?
Give me a sec.
Ah, okay. Bob.
Mr. Pawlenty will probably withdraw after his Iowa activities. He will probably withdraw from the presidential.
You're predicting Tim Pawlenty is going to pull out.
I don't think he's got the money. I don't think he's got the message. Unfortunately, he's a good man, but I don't think he's caught on fire.
Wow. Ralph, quick.
This fall, look for layoffs en masse on Wall Street.
Wow.
Good
interesting.
Idea.
John?
It's not necessarily a good thing for the Democrat Party, but you can no longer assume that despite the odds and the numbers, which we're going to go into in another show, that the Democrats are going to lose the Senate. The way things are breaking and changing, you can't assume that they are, even though they have to defend 24 seats.
Wow. I have a story. Believe it or not, as moderator, I have a story. It is the beginning of recall season. Make no mistake about it. Even as a Republican, I'm going to tell you right now, the cheesehead vote, the cheesehead recall movement happened today. Those numbers are going to come back. If you think for a second that the power and the money and the voice of big labor is dead, look at what's happening in Wisconsin, and it's not going to stop in Wisconsin. Bob, I got to tell you something. Target next. Watch. It's Ohio. You watch. Okay. Bob's going, oh, crap. That's not good. Make no mistake about it. His big labor is alive and well and kicking. And everybody knows where I'm getting that source. You know where my affiliations are, kids. Hey, Todd, you know what I'm talking about. Hey, this is on behalf of the Roundtable. By the way, Al, if you're listening, call Basecamp. We need to know where you at, dude. You don't do this usually. But we will be back next week, as we are every Tuesday, 4 to 6, live from Shelley's back room at 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Bob?
It's the place to be politics.
It is the place to be for politics. On behalf of Alan, John, Bob, Ralph, I'm your moderator, Justin Russell. We will be back again next week. Join us live on Blog Talk Radio as we continue our discussions of all things political. We will see you next week. Thanks for joining us, and I promise we'll get to phone calls. Thanks a lot, guys. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.